The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
More customers for your business? Are you facing new competitors? Not just across town, but across the country. How about across borders? How about worldwide? Welcome to Global Reach with your host, Tay Revez. As new technology makes it easier to connect with your customers, it also makes it easier for international competitors to reach them. Our program will help you stay competitive in a tough marketplace. Now, here's your host, Tay Revez.
Welcome back to Global Reach, everyone. This is a show that helps your business deal with the opportunities and risks in the global marketplace. This week, I'm here with Massimo Sterpi. He's one of the world's leading intellectual property protection attorneys, and he's calling in from Rome to talk about the emerging challenges to intellectual property protection in the global economy of the 21st century. How are emerging technologies, new media, globalization, new distribution channels all changing IP protection as we know it? And what are the particular challenges to protecting your IP in different jurisdictions, especially the transatlantic hub, U.S. and Europe? Massimo, welcome to Global Reach.
Thank you.
Before we go on a little bit further, let me tell the audience a bit more about your background. Massimo is a partner in Studio Legale Giacobazzi and Associates in Rome. He specializes in intellectual property and has enormous experience in transactional matters and litigation concerning trademark design, copyright, and patent. He advises companies on complex issues involving intellectual property rights, new technology, new media. He's litigated hundreds of infringement cases involving famous brands, designs, patents, and copyrights, and before international and national courts. He's a passionate art collector, and he is a special globally respected practice in art law. He's represented world-famous artists, institutions, and collectors. In 2011, he was voted Lawyer of the Year for Intellectual Property in Italy by the magazine Top Legal. And he's contributed to many publications, and he is a speaker at more conferences than you can shake a stick at. I've looked a lot of them up. So we're really fortunate that he's here today. Again, welcome, Massimo. I know this is a huge topic.
It's a large topic, and I'm very pleased to share some of the emerging issues with you and your audience.
You know, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce calls intellectual property the currency of the 21st century. So what are the key challenges that we're facing in the 21st century to keep that currency safe and sound? In other words, what are our challenges in protecting our intellectual property?
I find the definition very appropriate because I was just having a discussion today with an entrepreneur that runs a company that that focuses on innovation, and we were sharing with me that he had a discussion with a bank, and the bank director was admitting that whereas 10, 15 years ago, normally the intangible assets of a company were worth no more than 20% of the company itself, now the average value of the intangible within a company value is about 50%. So this gives you an idea how big is the importance and growing is the importance of the IP within a company. Because intangible, you have two kind of intangible. The intangible that you protect, and that's IP, and the intangible that you do not protect. And that's really like a gift to competitors. So if you don't protect your IP, you are just losing opportunities and you are giving your expertise and your research for free to others. So certainly IP protection is core when you understand that intangible is half of the value of your company on average. So that's huge. The second thing is that whereas we all recognize the importance of IP right now, the problem is that protecting IP is not automatic. Whereas you have some sort of automatic and worldwide protection in copyright, because through the Berne Convention, you cover almost 160 countries automatically, even without the need of a registration. For other kind of IP protection, in the first place, patents, and then you have trademarks and the registered designs, you need to protect them in each country. Sometimes you have the advantage of being able to take advantage of international treaties that permit you to cover several countries through one single application, but in most cases you have to go country by country. And you understand that doing that both under an administrative point of view and under a cost point of view is not an easy task. This means that to implement a worldwide IP protection scheme, you need to be huge. For a small company, it's not easy to implement a worldwide strategy. And that's why now big American corporations are so good at protecting their IP rights worldwide, whereas medium, small company, which are the typical scenario, for instance, in Italy, have a lot of difficulties in protecting their rights internationally. A very common case is that a company that have a very, let's say, evolved product or a very cutting-edge technology comes to foreign market imagining that they are bringing the novelty to those market, and the typical example is China, and they find that their own trademark has been already registered and their own patent have already been registered by somebody else, which is unbelievable.
What do you do for a company like that? A lot of my companies are in that situation, a lot of our listeners.
It's quite dramatic, because to go there and prove that the local company acted in bad faith is sometimes almost impossible. Because, you know, how do you prove that somebody that was in a small region of China was aware of your brand that was perfectly well known in Sicily? You know, it's how do you prove that there was access to that? How do you prove that your information from Sicily in Italian or English were available and accessible from Wenzhou? It's really strange. This situation is really, really difficult. And also, to litigate a case abroad, China is a good example, means translate all evidence into Chinese, wait for the timing and the schedule of the Chinese proceeding, meaning, in effect, that you will lose 3, 4, 5, 7 years before being able to enter the foreign market. So the suggestion that we always give to clients is, as soon as you create something that you believe is going to be international, not only national, local, cover that in the most important jurisdiction. And now, certainly, you cannot avoid, for an American company, you cannot avoid Europe as a whole, the European Union, but you have tools that permit you to protect the entire European Union with one single registration, China for sure, and then some other key country, which could be, of course, Korea, can be Japan, can be some country in South America. So you have to do that upfront, because when you launch the market, there will be somebody quick enough to get your brand, to get your technology before you arrive on the market, and occupy already the market before you come. So that's the real challenge, you know.
So the internet is the great research tool for your competitors or your would-be competitors, as well as the great tool for promoting your brand. Now, what are some of the other emerging issues that we're seeing today for intellectual property protection? You do a lot of work with the World Intellectual Property Organization. I know they're looking at emerging issues. So what about emerging technologies?
Yeah. The second enormous challenge, which in a sense is linked to the first one, is internet. Internet made...
Sorry.
I don't know what happened, but I hope nothing. The real challenge is internet, because whereas you can still decide to protect your brand in one country or the other, you can file a lawsuit against a company in a certain jurisdiction. Everything goes completely mad when you go onto internet. Where are the infringer? Where are they based? Where can you sue them? Is the jurisdiction the one where the server is hosted or where the company is based? Sometimes they give false identities. The addresses provided are completely, fancy. And so to find the infringer that are operating through the internet is a nightmare. And this is particularly true in counterfeiting. You know that there is a lot of counterfeiting about pharmaceutical product, about fashion product, bags.
And aspirational, but also even airplane parts.
Yes, absolutely. And spare parts of everything, cars, airplanes, whatever. Yeah, that's
Let
really,
me ask
really,
you something. We'll take a little diversion into counterfeiting, because counterfeiting has been a problem going back to when I was the editor of Business International, which is back to the 70s. How is this changing with the internet?
It's just booming. Because beforehand, of course, when you had your small factory and your small shop, so you were smuggling counterfeit in the street, the police was coming and taking you. But now, when you can put everything on a website, operate this website for 1 week, and then change your address and make a mirror copy of the website on a different domain name hosted in Tululu Island or in another atoll in the Seychelles, at that point it's almost impossible to be caught. And you know that the profit you can make with counterfeit are enormous, because you are just trading on the reputation created by somebody else. So you have no risk, actually. The counterfeit is a perfect business model, because you don't take any risk of launching new product. You just copy the product which are at the top of the market. So clearly there is a market for those kind of items.
What are the international organizations, and what are the IP protection attorneys like you who are in the vanguard of helping us? What are you guys doing to protect us?
You mentioned WIPO before, and I think that's a good point of reference. WIPO is doing its best to try to find new laws and new, what they call it, alternative dispute resolution methods, in order to try to solve this kind of problem, like turn down provision, like implementing international treaties that permit to request a website that with uncertain identity of the owner or trading in counterfeit to be turned down without a lengthy court proceeding, because that's too long. You cannot litigate for 2 years when a website is selling. You must turn down in 24 hours. So WIPO is trying to intervene into that, to try to persuade the countries to create international treaties to fight counterfeit trade on the internet. And the other issue they are trying to address also is the liability of internet service provider, which is the another enormous issue. Website like eBay or other website like there is a very very big correspondent to eBay in China, which is called Alibaba. They trade millions of objects every day, and some of them are explicitly defined in their advertisement, like replica watches, fake bags, counterfeit, imitation, whatever. So it's explicitly defined as a fake product. Nevertheless, they are on sale, and they are sold, actually. So at that point, of course, the brands are not willing to run after each single announcement for one single bag, but they want to go after eBay or Alibaba and trying to oblige them not to advertise or permit people to advertise products which are clearly fake.
About 1 minute to break. Very quickly, how are the big Alibabas being brought to task on this? Are they being disciplined, or is it still a free for all? Give me about 30 seconds.
Free for all there. Free for all there. Whereas against eBay, there were some court cases which were successful for the brand owners.
When we get back from break, I want to continue on this subject of brand. I'm particularly interested in some work that you've done on the cultural brand and the iconic brand, because it's so important today. After that, yes, we're going to talk about difference in the approach between the U.S. and Europe, which are two of the great sources of intellectual property. So don't go away. We'll be back in about 2 minutes.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. Need to hold focus groups in 7 countries or interview doctors in 57? Global Reach can get it done. Trying to expand into new markets, Global Reach will help you assess the opportunities, scope out the competition, and understand the risks. We are a strategic business intelligence firm with a network spanning over 60 countries. We can support your clinical trial recruitment campaign or identify the best practices to use when global branding. Founder and former editor of Business International, Tay Revez, brings 30 years of experience in helping companies from financial service to high tech to healthcare. She was cited by Super Searchers as one of the top 12 primary researchers within the U.S. Tay excels at in-depth interviews, custom multi-country studies, and out-of-the-box challenges. She's also been a featured speaker on subjects as diverse as baby boomers and co-branded credit cards. Let us help you with your next project. We'll work closely with you to define your needs and determine actionable solutions. Please contact us at globalreach-sbi.com or call 212-877-8616. Are you a business innovator, or are you just sitting on the sidelines? Tune in every week for Coffee Break with Game Changers, presented by SAP. Host Bonnie D. Graham talks to a cross-section of the movers and shakers who are leading by example. They will share best practices and innovative ideas to keep you thinking and moving along with the best. Join us for Coffee Break with Game Changers, presented by SAP, Wednesday mornings at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, 8 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel. When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. You are tuned in to Global Reach with Tay Revez. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you can send an email to trr@globalreach-sbi.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. I'm here with Massimo Sterpi, who is calling in from Rome. He's an IP, globally known intellectual property protection specialist, and he's telling us how we can protect our intellectual property. And we went to break, we were talking about brands. And I want to talk about a particular aspect of branding, iconic brands and cultural brands. There's a lot in the literature about it, but I find that they get confused. Can you define the difference between what is an iconic brand? Because I see that being an Apple, a Coke, an Izod shirt, Disney, and what is a cultural brand?
Okay, this is not legal stuff, but I'm very pleased to address this issue. Iconic brands are brands that went much beyond their distinctive role, but ended up impersonating like a personality, actually. So a brand like Disney represents an entire world. It's not just the link between a product and a company. It's an idea. They identify an entire mindset, an entire lifestyle that is embedded into brand. So when the brand reached that kind of status, at that point is defined an iconic brand. The cultural brand was instead a very specific kind of brand, which is the brand of a cultural institution like the Guggenheim or the MoMA. And I focus my attention on those brands because they have a very strong feel-good effect. And that's why so many other businesses are willing to sponsor or associate their brands to brands of a museum or cultural institution, because the mere association permitted to those other business to obtain a very good refreshment of their image, or to associate their image with very good and positive messages, the kind of messages that are normally linked to a cultural institution.
I see. So what are the key challenges? And very often we see that it's the iconic brand who's linking to the cultural brand. Where we see the sponsorship of, you know, Apple sponsoring a cultural institution.
Absolutely.
What are the key challenges in terms of an intellectual property protection perspective?
What we mentioned before is the fight of counterfeit with the counterfeiter. They're becoming like ghosts, invisible ghosts, hidden in the various corner of the internet. This is one of the big ones. Another challenge is the cost of IP litigation. This is particularly true in the States. The cost of enforcement of IP went really to the sky. Now, you risk to spend millions, to invest millions to litigate a patent case in the United States, which is not true in most European countries, except the UK, which has a similar cost. Let's say that protecting and enforcing your IP in Europe is still feasible. In America, is such a big business that is a small area only for the mega corporation. For the others, it's becoming a problem. Actually, this is a big challenge in the States.
Now, the U.S., U.K., and then Europe. We're each other's major trading partners. We are both major hubs of intellectual property, brands, patents, trademarks. And you said really different approaches to IP protection in the two regions. Can we start to look at that? Because there's so much IP in the transatlantic area. I mean, this is huge. What's the basic, in terms of thinking or history or legal approach, what's the signal difference between the U.S., U.K., the Anglo-Saxon, and the continental approach?
This varies depending on the kind of rights. The one where probably the difference is most striking is copyright. The same name gives you a lot of indication. In the European tradition, the continental Europe, we start from the concept of droit d'auteur, meaning the right of the author. You understand that the evidence is on the person of the creator. To the contrary, in Anglo-Saxon country, in the UK and the US, you talk about copyright, which is the right to copy, which is the industrial process of copying. So there, the accent is over the reproduction process and not very much on the author. The first consequence of this is that
really
in a continental Europe, emphasis is on the person and his personality. And then you have the very strong protection of so-called moral rights. So the right to be identified as the author of the work, the right to oppose any modification of your work, the right to oppose any derogatory treatment. All of this is not typical of the U.S., because in the U.S., once you created something and you are paid, that's it. And then what remains is the right to copy. And you understand that
the right to
creates
reproduce.
An enormous difference.
That's actually
right,
a very, very signal difference in philosophy and approach.
Absolutely. And that's why in the U.S. You have a creative industry. And in Europe, we tend to have, a group of artists, because the emphasis is so big that, just to give an example, in Germany, under German copyright law, the author of an artwork cannot assign the copyright. The copyright can only be licensed, because they cannot, under the German idea, they cannot be separated from the author. So the only possible arrangement is a license, but not an assignment. In the U.S., it's completely opposite. Under the work of for hire doctrine, when you create something under a commission, you sell all your rights, including, and you can even waive the right to be named as an author, which is, instead in Europe, you cannot waive the right to be named as an author. So it's is a philosophy. There is a philosophy behind that. Industrial, under the U.S. point of view, personal, under the, let's say, European point of view. So that's the most striking. But then we have many, many others.
Well, before you go from that, does it matter then where I take, which jurisdiction I get my copyright in first? Should I, if I'm an author, if I'm an artist, if I've written a film script, am I better off to take my first copyright in Europe then? Or does not, it doesn't matter, one doesn't supersede the other?
The response is very complex, but I will try to make it simple. Copyright protection depends on the place where you are enforcing it. So if you are an American author, but when you enforce your copyright in Italy, you enforce them under Italian law. The only limit is that you cannot enforce in Italy more rights than you could enforce in your home country. Okay? The cross-border protection of copyright is a fantastic mosaic of rule, and sometimes it's really very complex. But in general terms, the copyright varies from country to country where the authors want to enforce or to exploit it.
That's
why there is so much work for IP lawyers. It's so complex.
Territoriality,
it's a challenge.
So how does that play out in two of the greatest, two industries that are really under siege in our century, film and music? How does the differences in approach to copyright protection play out for that?
The idea that I explained before, that there is a different idea of copyright on the one hand, droit d'auteur on the other, already applies both to music and to film, for instance. So that's another thing. Another interesting aspect for a film industry is the role of the producer. Under European law, the authors of the film are the director, the author of the script, the author of the original music, and the producer is not an author of the film, but it has the right to exploit the copyright on behalf of the others. Okay? In the U.S., the financial aspect is so important that producer of a film is also an author of the film. Because the American idea is that it's so important that the amount of money you put in a film to create a certain kind of artwork or a different kind of artwork, that the producer role is so central that he's an author of the film. So you understand that there are really cultural differences.
Very deep ones. What about transformative work? I mean, traditionally that's criticism, commentary, news reporting, parody like Saturday Night Live or Le Canard Enchaîné. How do the U.S. and European approaches, the author versus the copy, how do they impact definitions of fair use?
That's another important difference. Fair use is an open concept, meaning that you have a copyright, which is a monopoly, and then you have fair use, that are uses where actually you are making use of a reproduction of the original work, but for purposes that do not impact too much on the market of the original work. And that's, again, the emphasis is on the market value of the original copyright, always. In Europe, where we are protecting not the right to copy, but the author personality, we have a completely different set of rules, which is not fair use, an open concept, where what counts most is not to alter or not to interfere with the market value of the original, but rather we have a limited list of exceptions, which are exception to the copyright. And then you may have some kind of reproduction for non-profit purposes within a cultural institution or very specific exceptions. And whatever is not covered by a specific exception is forbidden. So you understand that
Things like criticism and commentary, parody, which actually could affect the marketability of your copyrighted work.
Yeah, but these are more, they are more similar from one and the other of the ocean. You know, let's say that concepts like parody and criticism are normally shared between the two. What really changes is the concept of transformative. Transformative artwork was a definition created by an American judge in a Jeff Koons case, where he was using bits and pieces of other artworks to create a completely new artwork. And the judge said, yes, you used bits and pieces from a previous artwork, but they are mixed in such a completely different way, and the meaning of this work is so completely unrelated to the meaning of the original works that you transform so much the original material that your work is completely different from the others. Okay, so this was the transformative idea. And now you have cases in the U.S. about these transformative ideas. When we litigated similar cases in Europe, we couldn't use this transformative idea because it has no citizenship in our law. So we went very much more on this idea of criticism, parody, or even a completely new concept about let's say we had a case, a very important case involving an American artist, a famous American artist, John Baldessari, and he was accused of copying somebody else's work, whereas he was making a complete different, let's say he wanted to deliver a complete different message by using starting from the reproduction of another artist artwork.
Huh.
And
the we're going to take a break now because we're right at break time. We'll get back to this when we get back from break and then start talking about what the differences are in terms of patent protection and trademark protection. Don't go away.
Okay.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Bob Pritchard has over 30 years of experience as a straight-talking business consultant and author working with some of the top Fortune 500 companies. Now he's come to the Voice America Business Channel to help you and your business. Tune in to the Bob Pritchard Radio Show for information about starting and successfully running a profitable business. From the movers and shakers to great marketing screw-ups, you can't afford to miss a single edition of the Bob Pritchard Radio Show, Tuesdays at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern on Voice America Business.
Need to hold focus groups in 7 countries or interview doctors in 57? Global Reach can get it done. Trying to expand into new markets, Global Reach will help you assess the opportunities, scope out the competition, and understand the risks. We are a strategic business intelligence firm with a network spanning over 60 countries. We can support your clinical trial recruitment campaign or identify the best practices to use when global branding. Founder and former editor of Business International, Tay Revez, brings 30 years of experience in helping companies from financial service to high tech to healthcare. She was cited by Super Searchers as one of the top 12 primary researchers within the U.S. Tay excels at in-depth interviews, custom multi-country studies, and out-of-the-box challenges. She's also been a featured speaker on subjects as diverse as baby boomers and co-branded credit cards. Let us help you with your next project. We'll work closely with you to define your needs and determine actionable solutions. Please contact us at globalreach-sbi.com or call 212-877-8616. When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. You are tuned in to Global Reach with Tay Revez. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you can send an email to trr@globalreach-sbi.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm here with internationally renowned intellectual property protection attorney Massimo Sterpi. He's calling in from Rome. We were talking about the Baldessari case. You said it's a landmark case. Why do our listeners need to know about it? What's the key there that's important for them?
The key there was that for the first time in Europe, there was a sort of continental European interpretation of the concept of transformative art. Baldessari took a Giacometti sculpture that was expressing the thinness of the female body after the Second World War, after, you know, the Nazi camp took place, etc. And he used the same thin image of a woman to put them on a catwalk and transform those images into fashion models, to say that whereas at the end of the Second World War the thin body was an expression of deprivation and famine, now the same thin body is the expression of the self-imposed starving just to have a very thin body for the diktat of fashion. So clearly they just said that yes, the image is the same, but the concept you want to deliver is so different, is so completely different, that in a conceptual work what counts is the message you deliver and not the shape that you are using. And these are very strong.
So that's the key for our listeners, that it is the message.
Absolutely. Yes,
the protection is in the message.
Correct. Absolutely, which is very strong. In fact, it was reported everywhere, this case. I won this case last year, and it was reported internationally. It's mentioned everywhere. It was a very good case, and I was very pleased to be involved in such an innovative decision.
The medium is the message. Let's turn to patents. It's so very important in this emerging technology era. What are the key differences in approaches between the Anglo-Saxon and the continental Europe in protecting patentable technology?
There are very major differences, and also these differences have an impact on economy. The main difference that emerged when you had the first internet boom at the end of the 90s was the possibility in the States to protect the business methods. That was enormous. You know, you have the famous one-click patent of Amazon that permitted to buy a book by clicking one click on the screen, and it's clearly a method that was patented. You understand that by protecting a business method, you permit business ventures to invest a lot in an ICT project, a website and an e-commerce project, because the business model itself is protected and patented. Yeah. Whereas this is not the case in Europe, where business methods are not patentable. At that point, clearly, it's a problem for a business investor to invest in new ideas, in new ICT ideas, because they know that they cannot get a monopoly. And that's had an enormous impact on the development of the internet business in the States, and the less impressive development of the same business environment in Europe. That's a major difference. Another difference is the patentability of computer programs. In Europe, we selected a very strange idea that computer programs are protected through copyright and not through patent, but the difference is that the copyright protects only the software as written, not the idea within the software, whereas the patent protects the idea within the software. So, and that's maybe is not immediate to grab for a non-expert, but has an enormous impact, because it means that whereas in the States, if I have a patented software, I cannot make a different software written with different words, but that came to the same result. In Europe, I can create a software that does exactly the same thing that another software does, but if it is written with different words, it's not an infringement. So again, the protection of software in the States is much larger, and that's why also the industry boomed so much, because it was protected content, whereas in Europe is less protected.
Now, is that changing, or are we still at the same place, that you can only copyright computer programs in Europe, and you patent? Do you both patent and copyright computer programs in the U.S.?
Exactly, both. You protect both. One protect the form, the other protect the idea. And there is a lot of pressure in also in Europe now to go the American way, because otherwise there is a market imbalance. And clearly the balance is in favor of the states, because the more you protect, the more the industry grows. Now this concept sounds a bit strange, because you read in the papers there is a very strong reaction against copyright, against protection, because maybe is a bit misunderstood or underestimated that copyright protection, strong copyright protection, and strong protection of software through patent had such an enormous and several impact on the American economy. And but sometimes when you are very rich, you don't perceive that didn't happen by accident. So you just start complaining without understanding that it was the source of your wealth.
Now, you were talking about the existence of utility models, pet patents,
yes,
in Europe. Exactly what are you talking about there?
This is something that came out of Germany first. They are called pet patents, or small patents, because whereas to get a patent, you must prove that there is a substantial inventive step, meaning that a technician of that field would have been unable to come to that solution by himself. So the invention was somebody that came with a completely new idea. The pet patent is something that improve an invention that is already known and is already in the public domain, but makes the thing working a bit better. Just to make an example, imagine to have a bottle opener. The bottle opener is known, but you decide that you want to apply on the handle of the bottle opener some material that avoid that permit to grab it more solidly. At that point, you make a pet patent on the fact that your invention improve the ability to grab the bottle opener. So you didn't invent the bottle opener, but you created a bottle opener that works better than the previous one. So these exist in Italy, in Germany, in Spain, in other European countries, but do not exist in China, but do not exist in the States. In the States, that's an important difference. You need inventive step to get a patent.
Okay. We've got about 4 minutes to break, and I want to cover trademarks before we get there, but you had said one other key difference when it comes to litigation, if you have to defend your pattern. You were saying...
Yeah.
There's no discovery in Europe?
Yeah, that's the main difference, that has an enormous impact on cost. Apart UK, where you have basically a discovery, in continental Europe you do not have discovery. The rule is that each party has to file the documents in support of his own position and arguments. And you cannot request the other party to file documents that are contrary to their interest, unless you obtain special orders, the court ordering the other side to file a accountancy document of things. So, but that's quite rare and difficult to get. So clearly, the proceeding in Europe, you have to guess a lot of things, whereas in America, you just have access to everything. You pick up what you need to prove your case.
Button, who's got the button? But that is a really major difference in terms of choosing jurisdiction. Let's move on to trademark. Now, we talked a little bit about it before in terms of making sure you get your trademarks registered all over the world. But in terms of the U.S. and Europe, you've got many languages. You also said we had one law in the U.S. and many in Europe, but I thought there had to be a European directive covering trademark protection. Why would you have different laws then?
You have a European harmonization in trademark law. The problem is, however, that then you have to apply the trademark law nationally, and you still have different attitudes. Just to make an example, a country like Germany or the UK are quite strict against allowing registration of trademark which are descriptive. So if you go in to London and try to register a global business for a business magazine, they will probably refuse those registrations, saying that it's completely generic global business. Whereas if you go to the Italian trademark office or the French trademark office and you file global business, they will say perfectly fine. So you see, you can when you try to file a trademark around Europe, maybe the trademark will be deemed as descriptive or deceptive in certain jurisdiction and not in others, and that's one point. But the second point is that whereas when you get a federal registration in the state, you can sell wherever you want in the United States because you basically know that there should be no hurdle against your use. In Europe, when you start using a trademark in Italy, you make your availability searches in Italy, and you are okay. But then when you try to export in Germany, in France, in Sweden, in Hungary, you have to repeat the process every time because you may interfere with local national trademarks. So to get a trademark which is really free to be used in all European countries is a nightmare. So the market is still very much fragmented because of the existence of national registration. And
give me an example of a one company that had to do something very different with their trademark in two different European countries.
We have many cases in pharmaceutical products where the pharmaceutical companies are unable to use the same name for the same pharmaceutical product in different countries. Just to make you a very stupid example, aspirin. Aspirin is a perfectly valid trademark in Italy. Aspirin is considered generic and now no longer a trademark, but a generic name in many other European countries.
Okay. All right. That's a great example. We've got about 30 seconds to break. What's the biggest difference in assessment of damage or punitive damages? Give me about one or two sentences on that between the U.S. and Europe.
So one sentence, very easy. Punitive damages do not exist in Europe. You can only award the exact damages that you suffered, not three times the damages just because the other was acting in bad faith.
Okay, we're going to go to break now. When we get back, we're going to talk a little bit about one of your specialties, art law, and then turn to how our listeners can best develop a patent and intellectual property protection strategy and what the small and medium-sized firm can do at some kind of reasonable use of resources to do it. So don't go away.
Absolutely.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
Need to hold focus groups in 7 countries or interview doctors in 57? Global Reach can get it done. Trying to expand into new markets, Global Reach will help you assess the opportunities, scope out the competition, and understand the risks. We are a strategic business intelligence firm with a network spanning over 60 countries. We can support your clinical trial recruitment campaign or identify the best practices to use when global branding. Founder and former editor of Business International, Tay Revez, brings 30 years of experience in helping companies from financial service to high tech to healthcare. She was cited by Super Searchers as one of the top 12 primary researchers within the U.S. Tay excels at in-depth interviews, custom multi-country studies, and out-of-the-box challenges. She's also been a featured speaker on subjects as diverse as baby boomers and co-branded credit cards. Let us help you with your next project. We'll work closely with you to define your needs and determine actionable solutions. Please contact us at globalreach-sbi.com or call 212-877-8616.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio. Voice America Business Network.
Are tuned in to Global Reach with Tay Revez. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you can send an email to trr@globalreach-sbi.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back, everyone. Massimo Stirpi, Italian intellectual property protection attorney extraordinaire, is on the phone with us from Rome. We're talking now about one of his specialties. He's a passionate art collector, and he's developed a globally known practice protecting art. So you represent world-famous artists. You represent some of the leading art institutions in the world, and you represent collectors. Why is this important for our listeners?
Because for very wealthy individuals now, studies shows that sometimes 15 to 20% of their wealth is invested in artworks. And you understand that you cannot treat artworks like, minor object within your, patrimonium, but you have to consider them carefully. And there are so many laws about art, including copyright law, custom law, cultural goods law, export laws, succession law, and whatever, that there is a growing attention to these kind of assets because of their importance, of their value, and also with respect to the risk that you can run by moving art object from one country to the other. If you think about antiques, if you go to Mexico and get some very nice original Inca artworks, you can go to jail direct, because we are violating so many criminal laws by doing such a very simple act, that you better seek advice before doing that.
Let me move a little bit, because we're in the last segment of the show. We seem to be expanding our ideas of what constitutes an artwork. We have digital art. We have internet-based art. Just very briefly, because, again, this is an audience of international business executives and entrepreneurs. Yes. What should they know about the issues raised by the new notions of art?
The new notion of art have an impact on all the media and all the, the old kind of products which are based on, on a vision. Because whatever start in the art world, like new kind of film, new kind of expression, new kind of images created digitally or not digitally, whatever, end up in the mainstream culture as a commercial product. So clearly, by by paying attention to what's happening in the art world, clearly you are aware of what is going to happen next in the commercial world. So attention to the art world is essential for being aware of what is going to happen next in your own field.
So how should our listeners now start to develop a company strategy to protect their patents, their creative work, their other intellectual properties? What are the steps they need to do? And, of course, some of these are very big companies, so they do have their patent attorneys. We have a lot of small and medium-sized companies in the audience. How do they start to put together a global intellectual property protection strategy?
You must be selective, and you must be advised properly. What they absolutely must do is take advantage of the international treaty that permitted to file protection internationally through one single application. One is the Patent Convention Treaty that permits you to file a sort of a reservation of the extension of a patent to the entire world. And that's very important when you file, because at that point you have 2.5 years to extend your patent to most countries in the world. When you are filing a trademark to use the WIPO strategy, so to use the WIPO protocol and the Madrid agreement, the Madrid protocol and Madrid agreement that permits you to
Will that protect me when I go into that remote province in China?
Yes, absolutely, because you cover the entire China with one single registration that covers the entire country. And then to use a similar thing, even in design, for design protection, you have the community design, and with one application, you cover the entire European Union, which is 27 countries, which is, you know, a very, very, very big advantage. So for small, medium, small company, take advantage of the international treaties and cover as much as you can with the minimum cost. Then when you will growing more and more, you will be able to cover the, let's say, the uncovered corners, but at least you dominate already a very large number of countries.
Okay. When you're, I take it this is not DIY. You really do need to have a patent attorney to, or an IP protection attorney to do all this, or can you do it yourself?
I wouldn't recommend that. It's like to make your tax strategy by yourself. Very likely you end up in jail, so this is a kind of effort that I wouldn't recommend.
Are we better off having a single firm, or should we look to have coverage in the main jurisdictions?
There are two strategies. Let's say for a small company, they normally go to one attorney in the state, and the attorney in the state, and then he has his own network of associates in Europe. But a big company tend to do differently. They have internal department that have themselves direct connection with the foreign firms. That depends on the size. For a small, medium company, probably to entrust your entire portfolio to an American attorney that has an international network is the best strategy.
We have also many listeners based in Europe, so I would say, I guess, to a European attorney, an EU attorney. Can you summarize the key takeaways for our audience in about 1 minute? Just what are the two or three most important things that our audience should take away from this show?
Okay, first, realize where you are going to be next and protect your IP rights before going there. Second, protect as much as you can and as large as you can, because it helps your company. It also increases the value of the company, because now investors want to see that you protected your IP before investing in your company. And third, develop a strategy to select opportunities in the various country, even for litigation purposes. For instance, try to litigate in the place that costs less and is most effective.
That's terrific. Thank you so much, Massimo. Now, how can our readers get in touch with you, listeners, get in touch with you if they want?
Let's say if they put my name on the internet, they will normally find the website of my firm, and it will be easy to find me.
What's the URL of your firm?
Is Iacobacci -law.com.
Okay. JACOBACCI-law.com. Thank you so much. This was terrific.
My pleasure.
Next week, Victor Hugo Rodriguez, the president and CEO of LATAM Alternatives, is going to come back and talk to us about the lure and opportunities of Latin American hedge funds. We're also going to talk about what's next for Venezuela now that its controversial president, Hugo Chavez, seems to be in perennial treatment for recurring cancer. So once again, I want to thank everyone for joining us. I want to thank Massimo for calling in from Rome for an hour. Thank you, Massimo, again. I hope you'll come back.
Yeah. Thank you.
And for Massimo Sterpi and myself, we wish you great success in extending your global reach.
Thank you for listening to Global Reach with Tay Revez. Please join us again next Thursday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Have a great week.